Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
Hi, everybody. This is Jason Rosenbaum, a political correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. What you're about to hear is my conversation with Larry Tighe, the author of the new book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. It's the definitive biography of the Republican Wisconsin senator who gained notoriety and infamy for his crusade against communism in the 1950s. It was a path that led him to great public fame and historical scorn. This conversation was done in collaboration with Left Bank Books and is co-hosted by Shane Mullen.
I am Shane Mullen. I am the events host for Left Bank Books. I help produce our hundreds of author events each year with a fantastic team here in St. Louis. We will be taking questions from the audience at the end of the event, so please type your questions as a comment, and be sure to follow Left Bank Books on Facebook to be notified about all of our fantastic virtual events. And now for the main event. The definitive biography of the most dangerous demagogue in American history, based on first ever review of his personal and professional papers, medical and military records, and recently unsealed transcripts of his closed-door congressional hearings. In the long history of the American demagogue, from Huey Long to Donald Trump, never has one man caused so much damage in such a short time as Senator Joseph McCarthy. We still use McCarthyism to stand for outrageous charges of guilt by association, a weapon of polarizing slander. From 1950 to 1954, McCarthy destroyed many careers and even entire lives, whipping the nation into a frenzy of paranoia, accusation, loyalty oaths, and terror. When the public finally turned on him, he came crashing down, dying of alcoholism in 1957. Only now, through bestselling author Larry Tighe's exclusive look at the senator's records, can the full story be told. Demagogue is a masterful portrait of a human being capable of immense evil, yet beguiling charm. McCarthy was a tireless worker and a genuine war hero. His ambitions knew few limits. Neither did his socializing, his drinking, nor his gambling. When he finally made it to the Senate, he flailed around in search of an agenda and angered many with his sharp elbows and lack of integrity. Finally, after 3 years, he hit upon anti-communism by recklessly charging treason against everyone from George Marshall to much of the State Department. He became the most influential and controversial man in America. His chaotic, meteoric rise is a gripping and terrifying object lesson for us all. Yet his equally sudden fall from fame offers reason for hope that, given the rope, most American demagogues eventually hang themselves. John Kerry, the former U.S. Secretary of State, says, "Larry Tighe's demagogue nails the defining biography of Joe McCarthy. I grew up a Cold War kid watching it all on television. I thought I knew it all, but Tighe makes it real. To understand Donald Trump, you have to understand Joe McCarthy first, and Tighe's your guide." And William Cohen, former U.S. Secretary of Defense, says, "Tighe has written a fabulous, can't put down examination of one of the most dangerous politicians in American history. A demagogue is more than a biography. It's a warning of the peril we are facing." Larry Tighe is the best-selling author of Bobby Kennedy and Satchel, as well as Superman, The Father of Spin, Homelands, and Rising from the Rails, and co-author with Kitty Dukakis of Shock. Previously an award-winning reporter and national writer at the Boston Globe and a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, he now runs the Boston-based Health Coverage Fellowship. He lives in Massachusetts. So I will turn it over to Jason and Larry, and if everyone at home would please give them a round of applause.
First of all, congratulations on this really tremendous book. And I wanted to start off with a pretty simple opening question. What prompted you to write about Joe McCarthy?
So when I was doing my last book, it was biography of Bobby Kennedy. And of the 450 people that I interviewed, there was only one who was truly essential. And that was a woman named Ethel Kennedy, Bobby's widow, and who at the time of Bobby's death was the most popular woman in America. And she said something to me about Joe McCarthy that I couldn't get out of my head. She said that Joe McCarthy might have been a monster to much of America, but to the Kennedys, he was just plain Good Fun. And the idea of Joe McCarthy in Good Fun was so counterintuitive that I knew there must be more to his story than the monster half that we all knew about, and I was intrigued to try to find out about it.
That's one of the interesting things that I discovered from your book. There are a lot of people that really do find McCarthy in private to be like a really charming person. You mentioned in the book about how he seemed like he was pretty religious, but didn't really outwardly show it, but then had all of these other qualities that were really unsavory, like his propensity to lie all the time, just kind of his flailing when he was, you know, taking control of the Senate committee that was looking after communism. Why was there such like this dual perception of him based off all the source material that you found?
So I think he was the archetypal demagogue in American history. And like every demagogue, he had an extraordinary ability to zero in on real fears that Americans had at the time. And those fears were the fear of the Soviet Empire, the fear that shortly before he launched his crusade, that America had watched China go from nationalist China to red China. We had recently seen the atomic spies, the Rosenbergs, captured and tried and convicted. We were about to do something that I'm not sure listeners will believe unless they live through it. We were about to do something called duck and cover. And that was where every school kid in America was taught that if an atomic bomb exploded in their area, they should just put their hands over their head and duck under their desk, and that would protect them. And this was an era where there was profound fear. And McCarthy was incredibly smart at tapping into that fear. The problem was he tapped into it to offer solutions that weren't real solutions. So he was captivating. He was charismatic. He was the kind of guy that if he were around today, I would have loved to have gone out for a beer with at night. I just wouldn't have wanted to be one of his targets during the day because he was vicious when he was going after you, but he figured that everybody understood that that was just a game. And so at the end of the day, you would accept the terms of the game, you'd go out and have a beer with him, and you could all laugh it away.
There have been a lot of biographies about Joseph McCarthy, but I think one of the reasons this is such a groundbreaking one is the source material. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about how you came to some of the documentation and documents that I don't think any Joseph McCarthy biographer has ever found before.
Shortly after McCarthy died, 60 years ago, his widow left all of his personal and professional papers to his alma mater, Marquette University in Milwaukee, and left it with a provision that those papers would become public when one of two things happened. Either when their infant daughter died, and she is younger than me and probably healthier than me, or when she said those papers would open up. And for 60 years, biographers have been asking her to open up the papers. And to my shock, exactly 1 week after I had told my publisher and told my wife that we were not going to get access to the papers, I got an email from the wonderful archivist at Marquette saying, the family has decided that you should be able to have a look at the papers. And Jason, if you knew me well enough, you would know it wasn't because I was charming. And the question is why she said yes. And I'm not sure to this day why. It may have been that I was such a pain in the neck that the only way to get rid of me was to finally say yes. It may have been that I had as my, somebody who was arguing my case with the daughter was the daughter of Joe McCarthy's best friend, a journalist named Greta Van Susteren. And she was arguing my case. I was being a pain in the neck. The McCarthy family finally decided to say yes. And they said yes in a very strange way. They said, yes, you can look at them. We're going to turn the key and unlock these papers. But the day you get done with them, they go back under lock and key. So you have a look, but it's an exclusive look. And that might not have meant much if I had looked at those papers and they didn't have much in there. But it turns out they had everything from his real-time war records, war diaries, handwritten during World War II, to his love letters, to files marked top secret that were leaked to him by the FBI and the CIA. It had all the papers that a biographer dreams about to get a sense of what was better than we thought and what was worse than we thought about a controversial public figure like Joe McCarthy. And if those weren't good enough, the thing that shocked me the most was one day my wife and I were out for a walk early in the morning with our dog, and we saw at the head of our driveway an enormous brown box. And that box was another trove of papers that I've been asking for 2 years and that the government almost never releases. Those were McCarthy's medical records from Bethesda Naval Hospital, which showed the addictions he had. They showed the real cause of death, which turned out not to be the cause of death in the coroner's report. And they gave us another inside look at what this guy's life and his perishing at the young age of 48 was really all about.
One of the things that I really like about this book, and I almost majored in history, so maybe it's just because I kind of look at history and historical biographies differently, but when you like are taught history like in high school, there are some kind of assumptions that are told to you as a kid that you later find out aren't true. The classic one is that William Howard Taft got stuck in a bathtub because he was enormously fat. And if you actually like go to the Taft Museum, they'll say like that never happened. That's a total apocryphal. And with Joe McCarthy, this has happened a ton. Like there was an assumption that he went after gay people because he was secretly gay. There was the assumption that he didn't actually uncover any communists. There was also the assumption that like journalists like Edward R. Murrow went like really gung ho against him. And I think that you tried to establish that. While there's some elements of truth to some of those things, some of those other assumptions are completely wrong. I want you to talk about that because I think that's a lot of why some of the general assumptions about McCarthy kind of get into the public consciousness.
So actually, I think it's a good way, and it shows that you're the master NPR producer. And I want to, if I could tell you two brief stories, I'd like to look at one assumption about how bad he was that turned out to be wrong, and one assumption that made him look better than he deserved to be. And the bad one was, I mentioned that among the new papers that I got to look at were his real-time war diaries. And Joe McCarthy had said when he first campaigned for Senate, he had taken on the moniker Tail Gunner Joe, and he said, I was a World War II hero, and I'm going to come back and do for the state of Wisconsin what I did for the U.S. Marines in the South Pacific during World War II, which is heroic things. And all the journalists who were used to all of his embellishments said, you're a liar, and you were a land-based intelligence officer. You weren't up there flying planes, and you weren't a World War II hero. And that became the accepted version in your history books alongside Taft and his bathtub. They could have had a picture of Tail Gunner Joe and made fun of him. An entire NBC hour-long documentary was called Tail Gunner Joe, and it was not saying it in a favorable way. It was making fun of him for taking on that moniker. Well, we now know from his diaries and from letters in his files from his comrades in arms in the Marines that while he was officially a land-based intelligence officer, he volunteered for missions to fly planes. He often was back there as a tail gunner. He came under fire, and he didn't have to put himself at that kind of risk. So one of the lessons of this is, if you lie often enough, when you're telling the truth about as important a chapter in your history is whether or not you were a hero in the Marine Corps, people aren't going to believe you. And I'm here to tell you he was a hero. But I'm also here to tell you a second story, which is when he launched his campaign, his crusade against communism, which is why we're here 70 years later talking about him, that he was a bit of a fraud from the very first moment. And that moment was in Wheeling, West Virginia, on February 9, 1950, on what was known as the Lincoln Day Dinner, Republicans all across America celebrate their patron saint, Abe Lincoln's birthday. And if you're a prominent Republican, you get invited to cities like St. Louis and Boston, Washington and New York. If you're Joe McCarthy, a backbencher who looks like he will never serve more than one term in the Senate, you get invited to somewhere like Wheeling, West Virginia, which is where he went for that Lincoln Day dinner. He showed up there with a briefcase that actually had two speeches in it. One speech was on a topic that he knew something about, which was national housing policy, but it was a snoozer of a speech. And had he delivered that speech that night, Jason, you and I wouldn't be here tonight, 70 years later, caring about Joe McCarthy. But instead, he reached into his briefcase and he pulled out the second speech. And that was a barn burner of a speech on a topic that he knew nothing about, which was the idea of spies being rooted throughout the U.S. government. It was a speech that he probably had never read before that night. And he held up in his hand that night a sheaf of papers and said, "I have in my hand here a list of 205 spies in the U.S. State Department. They're people that President Truman should have known about. He should have rooted out. And I'm going to count them and name them." Now, we now know, and I could see from the records that were in his files, that whatever he had in his hand that night, it sure as heck wasn't the list of 205 spies. And if there were spies still in the State Department, Joe McCarthy was the last person who would have known about him. It was correctly, I think, said about him that he could have been dropped in the middle of Red Square on May Day and not recognized a communist. And so if he was a real wartime hero, he was certainly not a crusader who knew how to root communists, how to identify them and root them out of our government.
I want to continue on that Wheeling, West Virginia speech, because according to your book, Joe McCarthy sent a telegram to President Harry Truman, basically saying, "You better get on this communist problem in the State Department." I'm paraphrasing. That's not exactly what he said. But what I am going to say verbatim, because Truman's response is just remarkable here. "This is the first time in my experience, and I was 10 years in the Senate, that I have ever heard a senator trying to discredit his own government around the world. I am very sure that the people of Wisconsin are extremely sorry that you are represented by a person who has such little sense of responsibility as you have." So I know a lot about Truman because I'm a Missouri-based reporter. There's actually a lot of parallels about how Truman was able to get involved in politics because he was a war hero in World War I, and then he went to local office, and then he became a senator, which is basically what happened with McCarthy. Can you delve into why Truman and McCarthy disliked each other so much, especially since, at least on its face, both of them seem to have a common enemy in Russian communism, but they seem to just not like each other very much?
So I want to say one thing about the telegram that you read from Harry Truman. He never sent that. And that was a brilliant and incredibly strongly worded, but his staff convinced him not to do it. Truman's instinct, buck stops here, Harry Truman, was to point a finger and say, "McCarthy, you're a fraud." And he was right. But on the other hand, Harry Truman, as you point out, was an anti-communist. Harry Truman launched a loyalty program which had every one of 5 million employees for the federal government and applicants for jobs in the federal government go through a program that he said was required because it was a way of taking the teeth out of the anti-communism of people like Joe McCarthy. I think that in a way, a more legitimate thing to have called the red baiting campaign that Joe McCarthy called, that ended up being known as McCarthyism, might have been calling it Trumanism, because Truman arguably did something as irresponsible in going after communists, assuming that everybody in the government was in a way guilty. And the idea that everybody had to go through a loyalty check, to me, was a step too far. But I think Harry Truman and Joe McCarthy really despise one another, because having just said some critical things about Truman, I think Truman was an extraordinary stand-up guy. He was a down-to-earth guy. He resented phony populism. He was probably a much more legitimate populist than Joe McCarthy ever was. He resented Midwesterners who played on those roots to attack Eastern elites and establishments. Truman, everything about Joe McCarthy's holding up in his hand a set of lies, a phony document like that, just went against every instinct of Harry Truman. And yet he was not as good of a showman as Joe McCarthy. And I think Joe McCarthy got the better of Harry Truman. And one of the things Dwight Eisenhower, Truman's successor, said as soon as he got into office, he said, "I'm not going to make the mistakes that Harry Truman made by taking on McCarthy head on, because that didn't work." And on the one hand, he was right that it didn't work. And on the other hand, and I know he's from not far away from you, Dwight Eisenhower, I think that Eisenhower, our war hero president, who was right about so many things, was a coward in terms of the way he dealt with Joe McCarthy. And it's not just me who thought so. It was Dwight Eisenhower's brother, Milton Eisenhower, who pushed Dwight to take on McCarthy from day one, and Eisenhower wouldn't agree to do it.
Let's talk about the inauthenticness of McCarthy's ideology, because one of the things that you detail is kind of this cipher-like way of moving from issue to issue. Like, for example, he started off as a New Deal Democrat and then had to kind of hide that when he ran as for a judgeship in a very Republican state. You kind of alluded to that he didn't really seem to make communism or anti-communism a big part of his early Senate career. It was more about like housing or, you know, even pleasing some of his either constituents or campaign donors. Why do you think was the root of the fact that he didn't have like a really core ideology? Was it just that he was trying to basically play up to things that were seemingly popular? Or was it that he just wanted to obtain power and it didn't really matter how he did it?
The answer is yes and yes. I think that like any demagogue, power was a goal in and of itself. You didn't need to have not only strong positions on issues, you didn't need to have strong positions on ethics. That what defined him from his first race for an office, which was as class president of his law school class at Marquette University, to his last campaign for Senate, was the willingness to do anything. And I want to reemphasize the term anything to get power. He was an opportunist. When he first ran for that law school presidency of his class at Marquette, he made a deal with his chief opponent, a very nice guy named Charlie Curran. And the deal was that, like gentlemen, they would both vote for the other one. And each stuck to their guns in the first round, which ended up in a dead tie. In the face-off, McCarthy won by 2 votes, his vote and Charlie Curran's vote. And when Curran was outraged and said, "How could you do that?" He said, "Look, I was telling everybody to vote for the best man. And I decided I had to do that myself. You wouldn't want me to have done anything else." And that was a sign that Joe McCarthy, even when he tried in that first instance to vote for his opponent, he could only last that way for so long. That is what demagogues do, and Joe McCarthy did that so well. It wasn't that he wanted to get power because he had a program that he wanted to implement. He wanted to get power because he wanted to get power.
For people that have followed the McCarthy story from beginning to end, his downfall was when he tried to take down the military. And what you point out in your book is, even though he was in the military, and I'm very eager to join the military, probably to, you know, bolster his political career, he seemed to have like a real disillusionment with a lot of what the military stood for, even before he started, you know, his crusade against communism.
So I think it was not the military per se, it was military brass that he disliked. And he wrote really cynical notes about how incompetent the people who were guiding the war effort were during World War II. We see from his diaries that he was incredibly candid and incredibly disparaging. And I think it's part of his anti-elitism generally. He had no use for his fellow senators. He had no use for the presidents that he served under. And he definitely had no use for the generals and for the other leading the other leading officers in the military. And that's why it made it so easy for him in his last big campaign. He had already taken on the State Department. He had taken on the government printing office. He had taken on the Voice of America. And he had pointed to supposed spies in the White House. And his last campaign was saying that he was trying to root out nests of Soviet moles in the Army, and not just anywhere in the Army, but at a critical command and control center for all the units of the armed services at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. And what he learned there, and we can talk about this if you'd like to, was that there was one enemy that was too big to bully, and that was the armed services. And I think we're seeing that today in one of many replays of McCarthy in our current politics.
Well, let's talk about our current politics a little before we go backwards, because in the introduction of your book, you have a connection between people like Joe McCarthy, Huey Long, and Donald Trump. And I want you to kind of elaborate on that, because some of the parallels may be obvious, but maybe there's some more subtle things that you just mentioned. For example, some military people pushing back against the president, or former military people.
So I'd like to elaborate, and rather than naming Trump by name, I'm going to tell you some things about demagogues, and listeners can decide whether this fits Donald Trump or not. That I think that in lieu of solutions, I think what demagogues generally do is they point fingers. When they aim a wrecking ball at their assailants, and one of their manufactured enemies, one of their manufactured charges is proven hollow, the very next day they lob a fresh bombshell. When the news is bad, they blame the newsmen. If they can't charm them, they blame them. I think that if I could, I'd love to read you what I think is the most interesting quote from the 2016 Donald Trump campaign, the one that in my mind is most memorable. And that was when he told his supporters, as he was running for the White House, "I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters." And that, to me, was an incredibly dramatic statement. Exactly 62 years before, the famous polling pioneer, George Gallup, said this about Joe McCarthy's supporters. He said, "Even if it were known that McCarthy had killed 5 innocent children, they probably would still go along with him." And making a connection between Donald Trump and Joe McCarthy isn't just a matter of an author trying to sell books. There is a flesh and blood through line in the name of Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn was Joe McCarthy's protege, a very smart and very arrogant lawyer from New York that McCarthy hired as his chief of staff. He learned everything McCarthy had to teach. He reinforced every one of McCarthy's worst instincts. And exactly half a century later, the same Roy Cohn, who's no longer a young guy, is Donald Trump's tutor. When Trump was getting started in the cutthroat world of New York real estate, his father, Fred Trump, and Donald himself decided he needed a tutor. They hire Roy Cohn, who passes on every one of Joe McCarthy's messages, and Trump does everything that Cohn tells him to in real estate and then in politics. Every time as president that the president has gotten into trouble, he says, "I sure wish I had Roy Cohn at my side today." And I think what he's really saying is, "I sure wish I had Joe McCarthy at my side, but that would be too controversial." So instead, he says Roy Cohn.
Eventually, McCarthy did fall from public esteem to the point where he overstepped, as I mentioned, with the military, and he got censured. And that's been kind of the general end of the McCarthy story for a lot of like contemporary historical visions of him. But he was still in the Senate for 2.5 years after that, and his health started to decline. Was the censure that we talk about as so definitive really that definitive? And what happened after his fall from public esteem?
So if I could start for just a second at the beginning of 1954, this is when the process that you were talking about, the famous Army-McCarthy hearing start. Joe McCarthy at that point, George Gallup tells us, had exactly 50% of the public that thought he was doing a great job, which made him the second most popular figure in America, trailing only Ike. By the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings, when he had been on television every day for months and millions of Americans had tuned in, they saw him no longer as their champion. They saw him as the town bully that he looked like. So 50% at the start of the hearings, 34% popularity by the end of the hearings. That gave his fellow senators and gave Eisenhower the backbone to take him on. From August, when the hearings are over, to December, they have a chance to consider what they're going to do, and they decide in December to condemn him, to essentially censure him, a very rare thing. It had been done 6 or 7 times in the history of the Republic. So you ask whether that was the end of McCarthy, and you rightfully point out that he lives from the end of 54 to the middle of 1957. We know that he had lost most of his friends in the Senate. We know that his legions of supporters across the country had gone away. What we only now know, because of these medical records, because of all the treatment he was getting at Bethesda Naval Hospital, that he was drinking himself to death. He was drinking about a fifth of whiskey a day. He had was eating away at his liver and at his whole psyche. And we know now that what he died of was not the acute hepatitis that the coroner told us. We know now that he died of the effects of alcoholism. And it was too controversial to say that back then. And they didn't want to embarrass his family because alcoholism carried with it a stigma. But I think it would have done the country some good to know that alcoholism was a problem for its leading political figures and that it could kill them. And that is what it did to Joe McCarthy. Having said that his career seemed over at the end of 54 and he died in 57, as we know well today, he may have died in 57, but McCarthyism is alive and well. And he became the archetype for every bully that followed, be he George Wallace or David Duke or anybody who's around today.
I've noticed that there's been an attempt primarily among more conservative commentators to rehabilitate Joe McCarthy, which is not an unusual thing. Like, I've seen people try to make arguments that unpopular historical figures were not actually that bad and that, you know, popular historical figures are actually bad. Like, 20 years ago, we all thought Woodrow Wilson was like a top 5 president, and now everybody has realized what a garbage human being he was and what a terrible president he was. But it seems to me from reading your book that there may have been some redeeming personal qualities to him, but the unredeeming aspects of his personality and his actions are just so overwhelming that that case is a pretty weak one. So it's a 2-part question. What do you make of some of the attempts to resuscitate McCarthy's esteem over the past couple of decades? And are there any redeeming qualities about him that are redeeming? Sorry, that's a redundant question, but I'd like you to touch on both of those things.
Sure. So there are redeeming things about him. He was a war hero, as we discussed. He was a guy that I'd want to go out and have a drink with because he had this charming side to his personality. My book was neither an attempt to bury him nor to resurrect his reputation. Anybody who, and you are entirely right, that a lot of conservative politics in America is about redeeming figures that they say liberals unfairly buried. And I can't speak to anybody other than Joe McCarthy, but I can tell you nobody who is trying to redeem his reputation has read the papers that I did and seen the evidence there, because it just isn't there. And much as he had these charming sides, he was even more sinister than we thought he was and more cynical. And
I do have some questions, though, of my own. And a lot of what I, as like part of my queer studies courses in college, obviously the impact from McCarthy on the way that queer life had been before him and was beginning to go was severely impacted by him and his crusade. Why do you think he, because I mean, obviously communists, and that was kind of what a lot of the focus of what he was doing was, but why do you think he also focused on homosexuals?
So I want to answer that by partly talking about what he was doing in terms of his gay bashing campaigns and partly what he was doing generally. And I think he focused on gays for the same reasons he focused on Reds and for the same reasons I argue in the book that he was an anti-Semite. I think he went after every vulnerable group that he could. There was a lavender scare before Joe McCarthy, but he gave it a persona the same way he did the anti-communist movement, that he became the patron saint for gay bashing. And I think that it was total cynicism. And the only thing more cynical than Joe McCarthy going after gays was Roy Cohn, his aide and sidekick who was gay, being the biggest gay basher of all. And I think that some people have suggested that it was because McCarthy himself was gay and this was a way, as a fig leaf, sort of, if you point fingers, fingers won't be pointed back at you. I don't have any evidence of that, and I sure don't want to get involved with McCarthy's kind of smearing. I would just say that if there was anybody in America who was vulnerable, what McCarthy said in going after gays was that if you were gay and you served in a place like the State Department, that you were subject to blackmail, that the Soviets could come along and say, I am going to out you unless you cooperate with me and spy for me. And if there was anybody in America back then who was subject to that kind of blackmail, it was Joe McCarthy, who was a gambler, who was a had all kinds of charges leveled against him, that he did things today that the Me Too movement would have a field day with, that he was a liar. He had more things that anybody who knew his real record could blackmail him with. And I think it was just cynicism. And I'm sorry, it's a long-winded answer, and I wish I had a better answer, but nobody needed an excuse in those days to be anti-gay, to be anti-red, to be anti-Semitic.
So Judy asks, Larry Tai, thank you. Read the book. It's great. I'm the daughter of an HUAC victim, albeit an unlucky one, albeit an ultimately lucky one. Might you talk a bit more about A, the role of the press in McCarthy's ascendance, and B, the continuation of McCarthyism under other, presumably more proper auspices, clear through to the end of the 50s?
Yes. So can I just tell, for anybody who is too young to know what HUAC, H-U-A-C is, it's the House Un-American Activities Committee. And exactly 12 years before McCarthy launched his crusade in 1950, the chair of the House Un-American Activities Committee and his members were there doing similar red baiting and commie hunting. And they did it a bit more successfully, because everybody did it a bit more successfully than Joe McCarthy. There were some 24-carat communists around the government then, and most of them had been weeded out long before Joe McCarthy got there. But I'm impressed that one of the HUAC victims describes themselves as lucky, and I hope that your father or your mother, whoever was the HUAC victim, survived well, because so many of the targets of the House Un-American Activities Committee and Joe McCarthy did things ranging from watching their careers and their families destroyed to actually taking their own lives. And so anybody who can call themselves successful and lucky is a good thing. In terms of the role of the press, I'd love to talk about that. I'm a lifelong journalist, and it disturbs the heck out of me what Joe McCarthy did in exploiting the press. He chose for his first speech on communism Wheeling, West Virginia, for a reason that I think says a lot about his approach to the press. He understood that if he waved around a bunch of papers and said, I've got all these spies in the State Department, and he did that in Washington instead of Wheeling, West Virginia, there would have been reporters who that very night would have known who to call at the State Department and get comment. But if you're doing it at Wheeling, West Virginia, and the only two reporters who were there are a reporter for the Wheeling Intelligencer newspaper and a reporter for the Associated Press, they're not going to know who to call. They're not going to, at a dinner speech, have time to call them. McCarthy knew the rules that the press lived and died by, including their deadlines, and he turned those around to exploit the press in ensuring that his story would make page one and the story with feedback from his targets, their response, would not be in the paper till the following day and it would be on page 24. He charmed the press when he could do that and attacked them when that didn't work. The reporter in those days who most went after Joe McCarthy suffered tremendously for it. It was the most popular columnist in America, a guy named Drew Pearson. And one night, McCarthy, at a fancy supper club in Washington, ran into Drew Pearson in the men's cloakroom. He started slapping Pearson around. If a famous Quaker peacemaker named Richard Nixon hadn't stepped in between the two of them, he would have beaten him to a pulp. But that wasn't enough. The next week, McCarthy took to the Senate floor and made clear that he was going to go after Pearson's chief sponsor. Pearson had a very famous radio show. The chief sponsor was a company called Adam Hatz. And McCarthy told all of his supporters to boycott Adam Hatz until they withdrew their support from McCarthy. And they did that. He lost his sponsor, and he sent a chilling message to the entire press corps. And so the question is, the other half of Judy's question was, is the continuation of McCarthyism under other names continuing through to the end of the 1950s? And the answer is yes. And is it continuing through to today? And the answer is yes.
Before I ask Julie's question, I want Judy posted another comment saying, my father fired from his news writing job for taking the Fifth Amendment before the HUAC, became a freelance photographer. His big break was life. Henry Luce didn't care about the blacklist, let his editors hire the best talent money could buy. I think I gave you a book of Ted Polenbaum's photos at a conference some years back. I'm a friend of Dirk Van Susteren's and his wife, Maria Lisa Calta, whom I assure you know. So the continuation of the story.
This is a wonderful old home reunion, and I just want to make one comment about that. So Judy is entirely right about Henry Luce in his early days. Henry Luce ended up backing off from McCarthy because McCarthy again went after him with the vengeance. Luce was one of the only people in the early days to have the courage and stand up and call him a fraud. And anybody who did that paid a price for it. And history tells us in its very simplified version of events and in a very famous film called Good Night and Good Luck, that the guy who was the McCarthy slayer was a famous journalist named Edward R. Murrow. And that simply isn't true. Murrow came along, as he admitted himself, very late to the game. It wasn't until 53 and 54 that he went after McCarthy. And it was people like Judy's father and like Drew Pearson who were the real heroes who did it and paid the price for doing that early in their careers. And I wish that we got the story better for history, because lots of people who don't need the extra lionization got it, and the ones who deserved the credit for standing up to Joe McCarthy didn't get it where they ought to have.
So Julie asks, can you talk about the testimony of Joseph Welch? And thanks.
Yes. So thank you, Julia. And Joe Welch was a leprechaun-like lawyer who came from the Midwest, who ended up in Boston, and who represented the Army as a special counsel during the Army McCarthy hearings. And he uttered what might be the most famous words ever uttered by a lawyer anywhere in America. And they were in the middle of the Army McCarthy hearings, when McCarthy had attacked Welch's young legal associate. Joe Welch stands up and says, "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you no decency?" And that was a question, on the one hand, that much of America wanted to ask by the midpoint in the hearings. On the other hand, the only thing that Joe Welch was better at than being a lawyer was being an actor. And he was ready to ask that question, whether it was his young associate who was attacked or any time McCarthy gave him an opening. And he asked it with great drama. The world has credited him with bringing down Joe McCarthy. I think, as I said earlier, the thing that brought down Joe McCarthy was that America, and not Joe Welch, was by that point disillusioned with this town bully. And in the end, and this is what gives me great faith, and this is why my book is not a bad news book, it's a good news story. In the end, given the rope, demagogues throughout our history have hung themselves. In the end, given the time, America rediscovers its better nature and recognizes and calls out the bullies among us.
It seemed throughout your book that the press seemed to have a real hard time getting like basic facts right about things that McCarthy said or his background. And was that just sort of a product of the time that rigorous fact-checking just wasn't as seen as an ideal in journalism back then? Or was it just that people gave journalists information, they ran with it, and that was just sort of the thing to do? Because I saw it kind of on both sides. Like, there would be something that McCarthy would say to a reporter and they would run with it. And then there'd be like adversaries would say something. Can you touch on that phenomenon a little bit?
So I think on the one hand that the press has life is a whole lot easier in terms of fact checking today when you have an internet at your disposal and you have electronic archives from newspapers. You can check what somebody said yesterday and whether it jives with what they said today. And so on the one hand, that's giving the press an out. On the other hand, the press yesterday and the press today too often accept the hand-fed scoops that they have. Every reporter wants to be on page one or wants to be the lead story on that night's NPR news report. And we too often accept at face value without doing the hard fact-checking, especially if we've got a great source who's leaking us this stuff. So yes, the press didn't work as hard as it ought to. Yes, the press had a tough job. Yes, the press was intimidated by Joe McCarthy. And yes, in the end, the press exposed him as the fraud that he was. And I want to make a shameless pitch right now, which is, since Jason is here, and I think the press is our best safeguard against bullies. And my pitch is, public radio depends on public support. So after you buy the book from Shane's wonderful bookstore, make a donation to NPR or for whatever Missouri Public Broadcasting is called, because if you want to root bullies out of America today and anytime, it's journalists like that. And these days, it seems like NPR is one of the last great news organizations standing.
I appreciate you saying that. St. Louis Public Radio, by the way. And the other amazing thing about your book was just how journalists could like travel around the country back then. And there were like 10-part series on McCarthy, because it just seemed like resources were a lot more abundant back then.
Newspapers had money then, and they were like gold mines. They essentially had all the advertising from a community, and they had money to send reporters anywhere. And one of the best series, one of my favorite series, and I can't remember whether it was 17 parts, but an ungodly number, was in the New York Post, which was a great newspaper back then. And the series was called Smear Incorporated, and it was the Joe McCarthy story. And if people had just looked at what they were saying about McCarthy, then they would have gotten the story right and he would have been deposed a couple of years earlier. We now know from his private archives that he was following very closely and had a file on the reporters who were writing that series. He had every enemy that he had ever picked out, be they politician, be they community leader, or be they journalist. He had a file of smears ready to go, and he had an FBI and a CIA ready to leak him dirt on those people.
I have one final question for myself that I think might be of interest to the listeners as well. So in the beginning of the event, you mentioned that we are 70 years on and that kind of the interest in Joe McCarthy has been resurgent, like has been increasing. And do you think that over the course of history, will people continue to look at Joseph McCarthy as an example of a demagogue, or will he be overshadowed by some other other examples in history?
So I think if people, this is not just because I hope people continue buying my book, but I think Joe McCarthy was the archetype. Donald Trump was in a more powerful position, but he was clearly not the originator of all of his tactics. And I think we often want to go back, I hope, to the original source. And we could say the original source was in the days of our founding fathers, but Joe McCarthy was the one who best took all the lessons of the Huey Longs before him and translated them into something that was a powerful enough model that Donald Trump and whoever the demagogue is of tomorrow, I think will continue to go back to the original source, no matter how many people there have been in the intervening years.
Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this event. Jason, thank you so much for you and your listeners at NPR. We are big supporters of St. Louis NPR and happy to have you working on this event with us. Larry, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I cannot wait to pick up your book and dive in. I think that you have presented this incredible story and have an incredible way of telling the story. So thank you so much for your time this evening.
So thank you, Shane, for pulling it together. If you buy the book, buy it from Left Bank. And if you want a personalized signature, just let Sean know when you order your book.
Yeah, just leave a comment when you place the order as one of those things that you have to fill out. So leave a comment saying, I would like a personalized book plate. And I will let Larry know, and we will get you a book plate for your book.
Lazarus online, I received your message. You're a fan of mine, your name's Rebecca, and you've decided not to die.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.